But I'm on cue and everything else. Good afternoon. Today is, January 30th already. And today we're going to open the committee for the House Committee on Education Innovation. And it's my pleasure to also open up the informational hearing with meeting. And today we have a gentleman that does an incredible job that puts a whole bunch of information together in a very good package. And Richard Bielan's going to talk to us today. He's a state housing analysis for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Richard came to one of my community Saturday morning meetings one day during last session and told me about all this work that he's been doing and about the changing demographics. And I said, gosh, this would be good for education, so we understand what we're looking at in the future. And so I thought, well, after some of the information we heard last week, maybe we did need to have him come today and give us a little bit of background. The presentation, I believe, will be probably fairly comprehensive. Can we ask questions, Richard, as we go?
Yes.
Rather than holding them to the end. And so if you have a question, our good committee administrator will make sure that I'm paying attention, and because Rick's here to make sure we get our job done. So, Richard, if you would get it started, and please tell us your name for the record, and
okay,
we'll get going.
Chair Kong, members of the commission, my name is Richard Bieland. I reside at 888 Wilson Street, Woodburn, Oregon, and I'm here representing Oregon's Housing and Community Services Department. I thank you for this opportunity to present to you information that I've been developing on the changing demographics that are occurring not only in the United States but also across in Oregon, and share with you some of the impacts that it will have on our educational system. As I indicated, I'd be happy to answer any questions at any point in time.
Thank you.
When you talk about changing demographics, one of the things that you need to look at are changes taking place, and what are the characteristics of those changes? And certainly a significant component of demographic change is the change in racial and ethnic composition of our population. And if you're talking about demographics and race and ethnicity, I think it's important to have some definitions as to what we're talking about here. And therefore, a person of Hispanic or Latino ethnicity may be of any race. And this has been confused often in the past, where race and ethnicity have been mixed up and often are combined in a question asking what's your race and ethnicity, when they are really two separate components. For purposes of the presentation, a minority will represent any of the following: an individual of any race other than white only, a multiracial individual, or a person of Hispanic or Latino ethnicity. So by process of elimination, then, for purposes of the presentation, the non-minority or white only will be a white, non-Hispanic person. I think it's important to understand the changes that are taking place by looking at what's occurring in the United States, because Oregon is a part of the United States, and what occurs nationally often impacts us locally. So I'm going to start off by looking at, from a national standpoint, some of the changes that have been occurring over the last number of years. And I'm looking at the past three decades, from 1980 to 1990 and 2000. And you can see that Hispanics were 6.4% of the population in 1980. They grew to 9% in 1990 and 12.5% in the year 2000. Now, quite often you'll hear numbers and you'll hear percentages, but in order to really understand what's occurring, these can often mask what's really taking place. And so what I felt, in order to understand, we need to look at the percent of change and the percent increase of that change. And so you can see that in 1990, even though Hispanics were 9% of the U.S. population, they contributed almost 40% of the population growth in the United States during that 10-year time frame. Whites, who represented 3 out of 4, only contributed less than 20% of the population growth occurring in the United States. In fact, if we look at the projected source of population growth in the U.S. in the first half of this new century, we can see that from 2000, in the first half year, 90% of the population growth in the United States will be minorities. Only 10% is projected to be white. In fact, by the time we get out into the decade of the 40s, the new 40s, the white population in total will actually be decreasing. And at that point in time, 100% of the U.S. population growth will be minorities. If we look at how this is occurring by region, we can see that in every region of the United States, minorities have been increasing its percentage. But in the western United States, by 2010, 50% of the population in the western United States will be minorities. If we look at what portion of that is represented by Hispanic population, again, in every segment, they've been increasing, but in the west, even more so. And by 2010, 1 in 3 persons in the western United States will be Hispanic. Now, we, of course, are much impacted by our neighbors, and so I thought it'd be interesting to take a look at California's experience. And we can see that in the 80s, which is sort of the purple, Hispanics in the 80s represented 52% of California's population growth. But in the 90s, they represented almost 80% of California's population growth. And in fact, all of California's population growth in the 90s was minorities. They actually lost white population in the 90s, the largest state in the United States. Asians represent another significant portion of population growth, but not at the rate that the Hispanics represent. Now, we've been talking about percentages here, and sometimes it's meaningful to take a look at the actual numbers. And so I looked at California's population change from 1990 to 2000, and you can see that the growth rate in the non-Hispanic or Latino population in California was only 4%. The growth rate in the Hispanic population was 42.6%. And in fact, the 10-year increase in the Hispanic population during the 90s was just under 3.3 million, which is equivalent to the entire population of the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. In just 10 years, this was the growth of the Hispanic population in California. So I said, what are some of the significance of this? And I said, let's take a further look at California's demographics. In 1970, 4 in 5 Californians were white. Today, whites are in the minority, only 44.5% of California's population. Looking at the educational system, today in California, only 1 in 3 children in California's public school is white. 45% of the students in the California public school system are Latino. In fact, looking at Los Angeles, only 10% of Los Angeles public school systems are white. 70% are Latino. So 90% of Los Angeles public school students are minorities. In fact, in District F in the Los Angeles Unified School District, 60,000 students, 98% are minorities. Contains Belmont High School, 5,500 students, with a 40% graduation rate. 60% of those students are not even graduating high school. So let's take a look at what's happening in Oregon. Oregon's minority population has been increasing. Again, in 1980, minorities represented 6.7% of Oregon's population. That grew to 9.2% in 1990, and in the year 2000, it was 16.5%. Yet again, that's misleading, because if you look at that 9.2% of minority population, 52% of Oregon's population growth in the 90s was minorities, coming from only 9.2% of the population. In fact, if we look at race and ethnicity as a percent of Oregon's population, we can see that the black population is fairly stable, American Indian, Alaska Native, a slight increase. Asian and Pacific Islanders have had a fairly good growth rate as well. And this is sort of an anomaly, because the census reclassified things in the year 2000 and included two or more race categories in the other race category. But the Hispanic portion of Oregon's population was only 2.5% in 1980. By 1990, it was 4%, and by the year 2000, it had grown to 8% of Oregon's population. Well, again, you say 8%. That's a fairly small number yet. But again, it's misleading. Woodburn, I think, is a example of what's going to occur throughout much of Oregon. In 1980, Hispanics represented approximately 18% of Woodburn's population. By 1990, they were 31.4%, and by the year 2000, they had now achieved the majority status in the city of Woodburn, a little over 50%. So I said, well, okay, that's looking at the total systems. What are some of the impacts on service delivery and other issues? And education is a prime example of that. And so I asked the Woodburn School District to provide me with their student breakdown. And so I got for the last, from 1990 through 2005, looking at the demographics of the Woodburn School students. And again, Woodburn has a significant Russian population, so they actually classify what they call major culture, which is basically a white-only, non-Russian student population. You can see a slight decline in that from 1990 to 2005, but a dramatic increase in the Hispanic student population from 1,251 to 3,562 students in a 15-year time frame. That's a 185% increase over that time frame. And if you remember from the previous slide, Woodburn's Hispanic population in 1990 was 30%. In the year 2000, it was 50%. Yet 5 years later, we've had this increasingly dramatic increase in the number of students. So I'm not sure what Woodburn's population of Hispanics is at this point in time, significantly higher than the 50%. And this has occurred over just a 15-year time frame. So I said it'd be interesting to look at what's happening throughout the Oregon public school system. And so I looked at the minority enrollment from 1992 to 2004-2005, which is less than the 15-year time frame. And I said, was Woodburn unique? Or is this phenomena occurring throughout Oregon's public school system? Remember, in Woodburn, over a 15-year time frame, Hispanic student population increased by 185%. Throughout Oregon's public school system, over a shorter time period, Hispanics have increased by 188%. So this is not just a phenomenon that's occurring in Woodburn. It's occurring throughout Oregon, throughout our school system. So I said, well, I noticed that in Woodburn, the major culture quote had been decreasing. So I said, let's look at the white enrollment in Oregon's public school system. White enrollment in Oregon's public school system actually peaked in 1996-97. And since that point in time, has decreased by 12%. We have 12% less white students in Oregon's public school system today than we did back in 1996-97. In fact, a loss of 46,000 students. And so the presentation last week, people asked, said, well, maybe that's because people are going to private schools, homeschooled, and that. So I recently added this slide here, which is the percent of student enrollment by type of school throughout, and this is directly from the Oregon report card, and it shows that private schools had 41,000 students in 2005-2006. In 1992, they had 30,000 students. So there's only been an 11,000 increase in enrollment in the private schools. And I sit on the steering committee for the Oregon Population Survey, and we find out that a lot of Hispanics are enrolled in private schools because private schools are considered to be Catholic schools. Many of them are Catholic. And so you can't even say that the increase in enrollment of private schools from 30,000 to 41,000 is all white. A lot of that is also Hispanic. Looking at charter schools and you're looking at the home schools, do not anywhere come close, even assuming that they were zero at that point in time, of representing the decrease in white students enrolled in our public school system today. And I'll show you why this is occurring. In fact, if you look at population growth, there are two primary components of population growth. There's net migration, which is the number of people moving in less the number of people moving out, and of course natural increase, which is the number of births less the number of deaths. And you can see that the blue is sort of the natural increase, and it's been somewhat stable throughout Oregon, but there's been big swings in the net migration of Oregon's change in population. And in the 80s, when Oregon was going through some tough economic times, we lost a lot of people leaving Oregon to seek jobs elsewhere. But in the 90s, we're back up to a strong in-migration pattern again. Now, if you look at how immigration and immigrants come into the United States, there are six primary destination states in the United States: California, Texas, Florida, Illinois, New York, and New Jersey. We, of course, with our proximity to California, and there's been a pattern as they come in, they begin to disperse into adjoining states. And that is driving what's happening in Oregon, as well as Nevada and Arizona. Now, if we want to look at Oregon's foreign-born population by where they come from, we can see that 45% of them come from Latin America, about 27% from Asia, another 19% from Europe. So again, these represent the major components of population growth. But the Asian population growth was quite marked back about 15 years ago, and I think has really fallen off. Now, if we look at the legal status of the foreign-born population in 2000 and 2005, we can see that those who are naturalized citizens are approximately 32% in 2000, about 31% in 2005. Legal aliens, again, about 30 to 32%, about 28% in 2005. Undocumented aliens, about a quarter in 2000, and about 30% in 2005, with the balance coming from temporary residents and refugee arrivals. So that gives you an idea of the legal status of the foreign-born population. Now, if we look at the origin of those people who are illegal immigrants, we can see that adding in other Latin American countries and Mexico, this represents just under 80% of those who are in the U.S. illegally, the balance coming from Asia and Europe, Canada, and other nations. Now, that sort of gave you a picture of some of the migration patterns that are taking place.
Madam Chair, are we taking questions?
Yes, as we go, sure. Yes. Thank Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Back to the last slide, sir.
Yes.
Do you have any, do you track or can we, do we have data of what percentage of the people from Mexico do not speak Spanish?
Census has some of that data there, and I haven't, I don't have it in detail, but that is available through the census because they track where you were 5 years ago, and then they track your primary language in that. And the and I've got actually a slide coming up on limited English proficiency, which deals with some of those issues.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. What I know that in my experience with Commissioner on Children and Families, that a lot of the, not a lot, some of the population from Mexico, they speak Indian dialects and are not literate in Spanish. That's what
right.
I don't know what percentage that is, if that's 5 or 10 or 20% of.
I actually was asked to look at that. I forget the exact split out, but there are. I know in Woodburn now we have a radio station that's actually broadcasting in three languages directly for the Hispanic or Latino community. Spanish being one, and then two are sort of native American languages.
Thank you, sir.
The other component of population growth is natural increase, and that's, so I thought it'd be interesting to take a look at what impacts in Oregon are occurring because of racial and ethnic characteristics. And so I looked at births in 1981, 1991, and 2001 because we had statistics on the population existing in 1980, 90, and 2000 and births are 9 months later, and so it's basically a way to, if you know how many people were in 1980, you can get an idea of those contributed to the births in 1981. If you may remember, back in 1980, Hispanics represented 2.5% of Oregon's population. They contributed 2.7% of the births at that point in time. But looking at it, I actually deleted that slide, but if you look at the sex and age distribution of the Hispanic population, you will see that in the 17 to 34, there's much higher proportion of males than there are females in that age group. And so females, of course, contribute to the births. And so even though there are 2.5%, it's more heavily weighted to males at that point in time. In 1990, they were 4% of Oregon's population. They contributed 7.7% of the births. And in the year 2000, they were 8% of the population. They contributed 17.4% of the births. But again, natural increase is the difference between births and deaths. And so if you factor in deaths, they only contributed 1.4% of the deaths. So if you look at the natural increase that occurred in Oregon in 2001, Hispanics contributed 49% of the natural increase, even though there were only 8% of the population. So when you talk about, and I'll have some slides here that I think drive this home even further. There's been concern that, well, we have an immigration problem. We solve immigration problems. We're going to change the way things are occurring. That's not the case. In fact, looking at Oregon's population and you're looking at the characteristics of that population, in the non-Hispanic or Latino population, there's about 2.5 persons per household. And the Hispanic population, there's 4.3 persons per household. So even though in 2000 they were 8% of Oregon's population, they were less than 5% of the households at that point in time. And as a state housing analyst, worrying about housing units and things of this sort, this is a very important factor, because not only do we have a strong growth in the total numbers, but if we see any shift in the change in the average persons per household, we can even have a more dramatic shift in the number of households being formed and the services required to be delivered to those households. Now, if we look at Oregon's population, white minority from 80 through 2005, looking at white Hispanics and a non-Hispanic minority, again, back in 1980, Hispanics were 2.5% of Oregon's population. Other minorities represented 4.2%. In 90, Hispanics had grown to 4%. Other minorities, 5.3%. In the year 2000, 8%, 8.4%. But the year 2005, Hispanics now are almost 10% of the population and have now exceeded all other minority population segments combined. And you can see that trend is occurring quite rapidly. That's looking at Oregon's population in total. It's interesting to look at the source of Oregon's population growth to understand the dynamics that are taking place. Again, looking at population, Oregon's population growth in the 80s, Hispanics, even though they're only 2.5% of Oregon's population, they contributed 22.4% of the population growth in the 80s. Other minorities were 4.2%, contributed 18.5%. In the 90s, when Hispanics were 4%, they contributed 28% of the population growth. Other minorities contributed 24%. But now, in the first half of this decade, where in 2000 they were 8% of the population, they're contributing almost 40% of Oregon's current population growth. And the other minorities are falling off as their contribution to population growth. So again, minorities are representing over half of Oregon's population growth. That's looking at from the state as a whole. If you begin to look at the two different Oregons, I said let's look at the eight Oregon counties, which we had American Community Service data And those eight counties have 70% of Oregon's population. Two of these counties in the first half of this decade lost white population already, Benton County and Multnomah County. Marion County had almost 90% of Marion County's population growth, and the first 5 years of this decade were minorities, with the great majority of that being Hispanic. So that's looking at what's happening in where most of Oregon's population live. In fact, if we look at the eight counties, only 37% of the population growth in those eight counties were white in the first 5 years. Almost 63% were minorities. Looking at the balance of Oregon and the other 28 counties, still 70% of its population growth was white, about 25% Hispanic, and a very small percentage of minorities. So most of the minority growth is occurring in these eight counties. Now, going back to looking at the big picture of the relative impact of migration versus natural increase, I thought it would be interesting to look at the components of population change across the United States, breaking it out into the first 5 years. 49% of the U.S. population growth, it was Hispanic in the first 5 years. Less than 19% of the U.S. population growth was white. But looking at the natural increase, that same pattern exists. 48% of the natural increase in the U.S. population growth was Hispanic, even though there were only 12.5% of the entire population within the United States. Looking at migration, they only contributed 51.4% of migration during that 5 years. And so you're not seeing a significant, people are saying, well, it's all occurring because of migration. It isn't. You're not seeing an imbalance in population growth because of migration compared to natural increase. What was really interesting is I decided to take a look at the population change in the U.S. in the last year that I had some good data. At that point in time, from July of 2003 to July 2004, the white population in the United States increased by 515,000, or only 18% of that 1 year change. But if you disaggregate that, what's interesting is that within the United States, the under 45 white population is decreasing today. All of the white population growth occurring in the United States is 45 and older. Think of the implications of this, and I'll be sure getting into this very briefly here. Why is this occurring? It's occurring because of the changes in the age and sex distributions of our population. In fact, in 1990, the white population had this classic pyramid shape, with the under five and each succeeding five-year increment being a smaller size. By the 1950s, it was taking on less of a pyramid shape, and by the year 2000, it was taking on a barrel shape. But if you analyze that, you'll see that in the childbearing years, that's one of the smallest segments of the white population. In fact, the under five, which is the people entering into your school systems, forming families, forming future childbearing years, it's now smaller than until you get into the 60 and older population of the white population. So that's one of the reasons why these are taking place. But if you look at the Hispanic population, again, the childbearing years is one of the largest segments, and the under five is the largest segment. That's who's entering into the school system. Again, they'll be forming families, going into childbearing years, and driving your population changes that are occurring. Looking at all other populations within the United States, we again see that same pattern similar to the white, childbearing are one of the smallest components, and the under five being the smallest component. So what are some of the other implications here that are taking place? Back in 1960, This is the married children of under 18, quote, the all-American family. In 1960, 43% of Oregon's households were of this type. In 2000, only 22% of Oregon's households was that married couple with children under 18. The single parent with children under 18 has been growing dramatically. The only segment that has really stayed the same is families with no children under 18, again, reflecting the older white population that's occurring. The multi-person non-family households is also showing dramatic growth, as well as the single-person households. And I thought, well, maybe this is represented by increasing elderly people, but when I took the 65 and older as a percent of households, that only went from 8.9 to 9.1%, didn't account for the 23.5 to 26.1%. So what are some of the impacts of these demographic changes? If we look at the share of Hispanic population in 2000, 40% of the Hispanic population is first generation, 28% second generation, and 32% third generation. But that third generation, which is where you begin to see some possible significant changes because both the parent and the child were born in the United States, is remaining fairly constant, with just a slight decrease over the first generation and an actual increase in the second generation. And I almost question some of these numbers. I think these might be a little bit understated because this population is also more difficult to count, and a lot of the traditional counting mechanisms may not come up with a total real count of the existing population. But if you look at educational attainment for Hispanics, you can see that of the first generation, 54% do not complete high school. Another 24% do complete high school. But even into the second and third and beyond generations, a significant portion are not completing high school. In fact, if we look at the adults who are limited English proficient, we can see those that are native-born, 99% are English proficient. But if you get into the foreign-born, 44% of all foreign-born population is limited English proficient. And, of course, it depends on when they came in, with 60% of those who have come in from 1990 or beyond. What are some of the implications here? I thought it'd be interesting to look at, again, our educational system. And I pulled this off the Oregon report card. Looking at the percent of students meeting reading standards, we can see that in the third grade and 10th grade of the white population, 87% in the third grade met standards, only 55% in the 10th grade. Asian, fairly similar. But as you get into the other minority populations, you begin to see a significant drop-off. And then the Hispanic population, you can see, has the lowest level of students meeting reading standards. That same trend occurs when you look at those meeting mathematics standards. And, of course, when you think about our economy and our workforce, these are significant issues. In fact, if we look at the high school achievement gap, according to the E3 newsletter, only 1 in 4 Oregon students graduate high school ready for college. While Oregon's college-bound students lead the nation in SAT and ACT scores, a third of their peers fail to complete high school in 4 years. And according to Karen Phillips, while our high schools do well preparing some students for college, we need to change the way we educate teenagers to make sure all of them are equipped for success. I just added this slide yesterday afternoon. And this slide, I think, is going to have a huge impact. I thought it'd be interesting to look at the changing demographics on the number of college graduates. And I said, this is what's happened in the past when Hispanics represent 10% of high school students, other minorities 10%, and the white non-Hispanic 80% of students. I looked at their graduation rate. I looked at the percent of students graduating high school who then went on to college and graduated college. Here is the future. That is misleading. This is California's today, present. This is the composition of California's school system today. 45% Hispanic, 22% other minorities, and 33% white population. Now, you apply similar graduation rates. You apply similar rates of those who graduate going on and graduating college. And we now have where today approximately 30% of college graduates from high school students, 19% do not finish high school. In the future, instead of 30%, we're down to 20%, with 28% not even having a high school education. The impacts on our workforce, on our economy, are huge unless we make some systematic changes in changing these graduation rates and percent of people going on to college.
We have a question. Representative Cannon?
Yes, and first, thank you very much for your presentation. This is very, very helpful and information-packed. I do have some concerns that I want to just raise and maybe get your response on, and they have to do with using current rates to project future trends. And there are a couple of places where you've done this, and perhaps with good reason, but I'm a little concerned about it. One is on this slide where, again, you're correct to put up at the top that word assumptions, but these assumptions about future high school graduation rates based on what we currently know, what are the current graduation rates. I mean, I just have some question about that. And there was a similar projection, I think. It's on page 19 in our presentation. It's back a couple of slides. The title of the slide is Chart 4, Educational Attainment for Hispanics, where your slide would seem to suggest, I mean, it does suggest that third and fourth and fifth generation Hispanics have similar educational attainment profile to first and second, actually second generation Hispanics. And I just want to be careful and ask the committee to be careful about assuming that third generation Hispanics who's today are going to have much in common with third generation Hispanics whose parents or grandparents are just entering the country today, so that the third generation of 2050 may look quite different than the third generation of 1990 because of, you know, their families came here perhaps for different reasons, and they have grown up in different kinds of environments and cultures. So I just want to be careful, and particularly around this slide that you're displaying now, because I think there may be reason to think that, particularly with the kind of investment that our state is making, with the help of the folks up here in, for instance, ELL, that these kinds of graduation rates might change.
Those are excellent points, and that's why I want to, and I, again, this is, I just did this slide yesterday, so I need to work a little further on some of the percentages and maybe clear in why I say in this scenario, and maybe emphasize that this is an analysis under certain assumptions. But I think that these assumptions are, whether they might change somewhat, still you can begin to see the direction that's occurring. And that's the intent of a slide like this, is to point out that if we don't change what the historical averages have been, we're going to be finding ourselves in this situation.
Representative Roebling.
Thank you. I'm just going to follow up on the same one. And you just about got to it right with your last statement. And that is, part of this assumption is that we don't change how we do business.
Mm. Right.
And I guess the other assumption that we should at least ask ourselves to consider is that with that change in demographics and the students that we have, that we had better start looking at different ways to educate kids, because they are coming to us with different sets of information. And we haven't necessarily done that as well in the past in a lot of places, because they hadn't really realized that it was coming. And unlike Woodburn, most of us haven't made that switch. And so they're ahead of us. And so we need to find out what Woodburn's doing, where they're being successful, and make sure that the rest of the state knows about that, and we learn from each other over the next little while, so that that graph doesn't turn out that way, which I believe we can change that graph. But if we don't look at it right now and be honest with ourselves, that if we keep doing the things the same way, that's what we have to look forward to. So I appreciate the slide. I think that's a very good reason to have the slide there.
And the other comment that I'd make, Representative Roblin, is somebody that taught in the system during those 15 years of change, it moves so fast, you don't have time to respond. And so the purposefulness of us as a committee is to think, okay, this, we are evolving, we are changing, and I used to give my superintendent a bad time almost every year because we are always in a process of change. I said, are we ever going to design this airplane on the ground? Because we're always in the process of construction of what we need to do to meet the kids. It was so urgent that we never, I mean, we did strategic planning, but boy, it changed, you know, in 6 months. It's supposed to be a 10-year plan. So, yeah, it does change before you can really know that it's happening to you.
If we want to take a look at the U.S. share of highly educated workers from 1970 to 2000, in 1970, 30% of the world's enrollment of college was in the United States. In 2000, that was down to 14%. In 1975, we had 40% of those graduating with science and engineering PhDs. By 2010, it's going to be down to 15%. In fact, China by 2010 will graduate more PhDs in science and engineering than the U.S. So this begins to paint some of the global picture here.
That's right.
We
should have that number.
Now, when you look at some of the impacts of these demographic changes, and if we do not increase our educational level of a burgeoning part of our population, our labor supply, in basically in 2010, when baby boomers start to retire, we're seeing a significant decrease in the number of people coming into the labor force in the United States. In fact, I took a look at the Hispanics in the U.S. labor force through 2000 to 2020. Again, they were 12.5% of the population. They're estimated to contribute 52% of the increase in the U.S. labor force in the first 20 years of this century. They're already representing half of the growth in the labor force. The labor force is the economic engine that drives us. So I said, let's take a look at worker earnings by race, ethnicity, and educational attainment. And it's not surprising, again, white alone and Asian have very similar worker earnings. Hispanics have the lowest level, in fact, slightly lower than those with just a high school education in general. And then, of course, as you get some college and a college degree, your earnings increase significantly. So I said, what are some of the economic implications of this? So I thought it'd be interesting to look at the per capita income as a percent of white-only per capita income by these race and ethnic categories. And I set, based on 2005 reported income, the white per capita income was set at 100%. Hispanic per capita income was only 44% of that. Black, 62%. American Indian, Alaska Native. Again, Asian, almost 90%. Native Hawaiian, other Pacific Islander. But this was the smallest portion, and again, it's per capita income that drives the economy. So I said, what are some of the fiscal implications involved here? So I thought it'd be interesting to run a tax return, both a federal and a state tax return, looking at the median white household family and the median Hispanic family, looking at the median size of that family, and running a federal and state tax return. The median non-white, non-Hispanic family income was $55,000. The median Hispanic multifamily income was $31,000. But when I ran the tax returns, the tax implications were dramatic. The white household family paid $3,059 in taxes. From a federal standpoint, the Hispanic household qualified for a $3,000 tax rebate, primarily because of the children qualifying for child care credits, child tax credits, earned income credits. And so there's 100% loss from federal revenues because of this change. And this is the median. So half make more, half make less, both from the white. And if we're going through a substitution and the substitution is taking place, the implications on our revenue system, I think, are immense. I did the same thing for Oregon. And again, that same phenomena existed. I actually did this a couple of years ago, and I did it based on, I think it was 2000 results. And at that point in time, Oregon was still getting some revenue from the Hispanic household, but there, because of recent changes in the specifically the working family child care credit, which is a new addition to the Oregon taxes, that has now put Oregon into a negative situation from a revenue standpoint. If we're going through this substitution without, and if we don't increase the earnings power of these households, this is serious, significant fiscal implications for both the state and the federal government. So what are some of these demographic impacts? We can see that the racial ethnic composition of our public school systems are changing very rapidly in Oregon, that the minority population is generally less educated with significantly lower earnings capacity, that the white educated baby boomers begin retiring in 2010, that the workforce growth will mostly come from minority population, already 52% of it coming from the Hispanic population, and that federal and state revenues will be negatively impacted unless minority earnings increase. Okay, I had slides showing that if you look at the ratio of workers to people over 65, we're seeing dramatic changes in that. I mean, in 1960, I think there were 8.6 workers for everyone age 65. And by 2000, it was down to 4.3 if you looked at, and that was the number of people in the work age group. If you looked at the workers, it was down to like 3.3. And by 2030, it was down to 2.8. By 2050, it was down to 2.3. And so if you look at the composition of those workers, their earnings power, the implications on our retirement system, Social Security, all of that is huge. So in conclusions, we're rapidly changing from what has been a nation of primarily white and non-Hispanic to a very racially and ethnically diverse population, that the Hispanic, Latino, and Asian populations are the fastest growing cohorts, white only the slowest, actually decreasing in one of the primary age groups, under 45, and will be decreasing in total later on, and that Hispanic Latino population now accounts for half of the population growth, and therefore planning and policy decisions in education, housing, social services, and any other form of delivery to our population had better reflect these patterns of growth.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair. And just to add something, I've seen similar slides before about the ratio of worker, our tax base to retirees, that as that demographic goes out, that the age of people is getting older and older. We have people living longer.
Yes.
And that base of retirees is 80, and so it's even the health care resources.
Well, I had one slide in here, I mean, which I didn't show today, but showing that over the first 20 or 30 years of this decade, the growth in the labor force was 27%. The growth in the 65 and over was over 100%. Mm-hmm. And so we have an increasing smaller segment of our population with lower earnings power supporting a very rapidly growing senior population with some very different ethnic and racial characteristics of those two segments of the population. That's basically the end of my presentation here.
Well, I appreciate your time. I'm sure people have some pondering thoughts. I guess that's maybe Mr. Bialin gave us the reason why this committee is called Education Innovation. That we need to think forward and wisely about some of our decisions. Any questions or thoughts by committee members? Representative Buckley?
Madam Chair, it just strikes me, and it seems like an obvious question, I might as well ask it out loud. Where can we find excellence in Hispanic education? I mean, if we're talking about a Hispanic population, and that demographic is rising so much, where is the model? Is there a model now of excellence?
To engage students?
To engage students.
And keep them motivated?
Keep them motivated.
That's what education innovation is about.
Well, that's what I'm asking, where
we're
going
to find it. I don't know. We haven't found the answer yet. I don't know. Maybe some of my colleagues here have some suggestions.
I don't think that we've had, acquisition of language and reading and getting those kinds of things. I think if we want to look at where the best research that I have seen is, it's in New Zealand. New Zealand has done an amazing job of reading acquisition with populations of Maori and others, and they have systematically gone about improving that ability to have bilingual people teaching in both languages and making it work. We have been, it appears in my looking at it, we've been a little schizophrenic about it. We start off on one sesh and thinking we'll keep in their language for a while and the others, and we haven't come up with an answer. And the other problem that I think our other representative mentioned was that we have to get an answer to teaching all kids with different languages, because the Hispanic group that we have doesn't have the same language, and they don't come with the same academic skills, translating their verbal language to written language. So there's a lot of issues that I don't think we've done the research yet to come up with. I think there are some best practices, but we still have a long ways to go.
Well, in the comment that I would give, that we learned a model in some of our adventures in Woodburn, is many times students, if they just use one kind of set pattern to teach students how to learn how to read, speak, and write, they plateau at fifth grade.
Right.
They get stuck there. And then they came to me at middle school, and it's like, what happened to these kids? But they reach a plateau, and it's a blend of strategies that, because there's no answer
one size fits all.
No, it really doesn't. And so then it really comes back to the art of teaching. It's just not in a book. It's not going to give you the answer. It's in the art of teaching and teaching to every child. Yeah, Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, thank you. From the other representative. I haven't done as much reading as some members of this committee may have, but I know that in Germany, they had a tremendous increase in a minority population of Turks after World War II, and I don't know if they addressed that issue. Even England and some of those, had with the Indian and the, of course, that was English speaking, but some of the Muslims that come into England, if they've had any success or any programs to try to adapt to this.
Right.
I think that's. I think this was very interesting. I've gotten other briefings on the demographics as far as, within Oregon, because we do have areas and pockets where this is not, still not affecting, or we're not seeing this sort of changes, and that makes it different in the education system, because we can't one size fits all, or one program is not going to fit all. The coast is declining tremendously. Enrollment down there as we get more and more retirees and things like that, and so it's a real problem. But again, I looked at some of the New Zealand study, but I don't know if there's anything in England or Germany that we could help us in our work.
And just a quick response to that. I'm glad you bring up those examples. They are countries that have experienced this kind of change, perhaps not to this degree, and they're countries that continue to struggle with many of these same questions, and we're not alone in that regard. In my time in England, both studying what was happening in England as well as what was happening in other parts of the world, left me with few sort of hard and fast answers and a high degree of solidarity with nations all over the world and school systems all over the world. And I was really focused on school systems that are trying to understand and are grappling with many of the same questions that we are. I certainly will look forward to reviewing some of the research that I did there and seeing whether there may be models that I could bring before the committee as a possible idea about innovation in other parts of the world. And New Zealand also, you know, it did come up in that context as well.
Well, the other comment that it brings to my mind is a sense of urgency, that we can't look at education possibly in the same way we have always looked at it. We have done it in a systematic way that, okay, everybody's got to sit at their desk and everybody's has to do it a certain way. Our desks can't be in a row anymore. If they need to work together or whatever the strategies are, I mean, it's time to look at the whole system. I guess that's because we're not reaching those children. I don't know of all the innovation that's been going on in California. Their statistics aren't very heartwarming. And so it is. It's going to be a huge challenge. What are we going to do? And as leaders in the state, you know, we just sit here and keep the wheels spinning as they're spinning. I don't think that that's necessarily the right answer at this stage. So any other last moments? Any last questions for Mr. Bialik? Because he does have a much more comprehensive overview of all these things, and you have a web page where this can be found.
Yes, it's actually my full presentation is available at that on our website, the OHCS website.
Okay, there. Because it is much more comprehensive than what we saw today. So, if you have people that want to see it or take a look at the whole thing, Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick question: I've had the presentation last year. What's the growth as far as school-age children? Are we going to have, we're talking about it could be even a decline in school enrollment from the 550,000?
Well, we're actually still seeing growth in the overall public school system, but again, it's because whites are going down and minorities and primarily Hispanics are increasing at a more rapid rate. So the total numbers are still increasing.
Slightly.
Right.
Madam Chair,
and that depends, like you say, on the location in the coastal areas.
Yeah.
And we're seeing lower enrollments, and even some of Eastern Oregon. That we have some counties that are actually losing population today.
Yeah, I appreciate, Madam Chair, your sort of call to urgency around this issue and bringing our guests here to really sort of fire us up with these. I'm looking at the Oregonian headline. Fire us up with these
wrong issue
statistics. I also think maybe we won't have many opportunities like this to express also the sense I feel of humility on an education committee charged with helping address some of these challenges, but also realizing that education is just a little piece of it. You know, the public looks to the education system. I look to the education system because it is such a massive public investment to take on these vast problems. I think we also have to recognize the limitations. You know, that school is just a little part of these the lives of these families, and there are limits to what the education system will be able to do. And I know we all know that, but I think sometimes sitting on this dais, the House Committee on Education, and legislature elected by public that's saying schools, it's possible to sort of you know, get some hubris and think, yep, schools are gonna solve the problem. Well, schools are a big part of it, and I've invested my life and my family's invested its life in education because we believe that, but at the same time there are certainly limits.
Well, and my last statement would be to the committee, and since we aren't rushed to get out the door for another committee to meet in here today, I'd just like to mention two things, and that is, and I've shared this with Representative Buckley as the chair of the full committee, I don't believe there's any single answer. That's philosophically where I am. And so that sometimes, you know, people outside of our colleagues here might wonder why we're hearing certain bills. And I believe bills that give a different light or a different perspective, at least we can bring the dialogue to this room, and whether a bill moves forward with all of us in, you know, pretty much consensus or however it is, then that's a great step, but I don't think we can just say, oh, we're not going to hear a certain bill. And so just that, you know, we'll probably have a wide range of issues and people talking from a wide range of perspectives. And so, but I don't know how else to get the dialogue going. And so, and one other thing that I asked our wonderful staff, and then they said that was a Ramona question, but I've been thinking about this, and I've been, and Ramona said, because I'd like to have students up here at the dais, and not necessarily Ramona said they can come up and be here, but they can't ask questions, so that if you had a question, if Representative Minnis had two students from her district, well, she could sit by them, and they can always write her a note or something, but I don't know what your thoughts are. You can get back to me about that. But they certainly have a perspective, and Lord knows most of these children, I mean, Representative Cannon's younger than my children, have... yeah, I mean, seriously. Oh. Yes, you are.
That's true.
He's young.
which one of you is the reddest?
well, he shouldn't be. I mean, I want to honor the intellect that we are having in our schools and have those, you know, children, young people that, you know, maybe they're thinking about how we can do something different. But I open that invitation to any of you. And, you know, if you have students in your district that you'd like to have them, you know, participate at the dais. They are not elected officials, but they certainly, it's my understanding that they can sit up here, but, you know, think about it and let me know what your thoughts are. If you're comfortable with that, and if you're not, please let me know that too. So, I love being a teacher. Thank you, Mr. B. Allen. Thanks, committee. We're closing the hearing.
Thank you.